Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. A monitoring group says a series of truck bombs in a Kurdish-held town in northeast Syria has killed at least 22 people, including several women and a doctor. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said the bombs went off near a health center and vegetable market in the town of Tel Tamer in Hasakeh province. The Britain-based group, which has a network of contacts on the ground in Syria, said dozens were wounded in the late Thursday attacks. Tel Tamer is controlled by Kurdish YPG forces, which have for months been battling Islamic State extremists in the area with the help of U.S.-led airstrikes. The Taliban claimed responsibility for an attack in central Kabul Friday evening. A massive explosion, followed by bursts of gunfire, could be heard about 6 p.m. Friday in the affluent Sherpur area near diplomatic missions and government buildings. The Taliban said multiple suicide bombers attacked a guest house in the area and inflicted heavy casualties. There was no official confirmation of that account, however. The attack is said to have taken place near the Spanish embassy in the Afghan capital. The Taliban statement said the target was a guest house used by foreign invaders. Interior Ministry spokesman Sadiq Siddiqui tweeted that a car bomb appeared to be the source of the explosion. Heavy gunfire followed the first massive explosion, and a reporter near the scene said police reported at least three attackers were involved. Friday's attack in Kabul followed a 27-hour siege of the airport in southern Kandahar City on Tuesday. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry spoke to reporters at the U.N. climate talks in Paris.
We had a very constructive meeting. There's a lot of progress made last night, a long night.
Kerry met with French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius Friday after what sources said was a hard night of negotiations among the 195 nations at the Paris meetings. Fabius said the final agreement and conclusion of the talks was extended by a day until Saturday. The biggest disagreements have been over how much financial responsibility poorer nations should take for the cost of cutting greenhouse gas emissions and what the stated long-term goal of the agreement should be. In another development, China said President Xi Jinping spoke by telephone with U.S. President Barack Obama to discuss climate change. North and South Korea have held high-level talks for the first time in nearly 2 years, with both sides expressing a desire to improve long-strained ties. The vice ministerial-level meeting was held Friday at the Kaesong Industrial Complex, just north of the tense demilitarized zone separating the two countries. South Korean Vice Unification Minister Hwang Boo-gi and his North Korean counterpart, Jeon Jong-soo, struck an optimistic tone as they shook hands at the beginning of the dialogue. The talks were agreed to in August as part of a deal that ended a standoff over a landmine incident that wounded two South Korean soldiers near the border. There is no official agenda for the talks, and no significant breakthroughs are expected, though each side is thought to have clear goals. Pyongyang is expected to push for the resumption of South Korean tours to its scenic Mount Kumgang resort. Brian Padden is VOA's correspondent in Seoul.
South Korea would like more of these inter-Korean separated family reunions, similar to the one that just happened about a month ago. That was the first time in about 2 years. So they want to make that a regular and permanent type of setup.
The last such meeting was held in October. A Burundian army spokesman says 12 gunmen who attacked military bases in the capital Friday were killed as soldiers clashed with their attackers. Colonel Gaspar Baratuza said in a statement that 21 attackers were captured along with some arms and explosives. He said 5 soldiers were wounded. However, army soldiers, speaking on condition of anonymity, said that at least 3 soldiers were killed. Gunfire and explosions were heard around Bujumbura after the identified gunmen attacked at least 2 military sites. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiye Swuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Many NGOs and civil society groups, they fear that this document is not going far enough in terms of specific commitments to reach that target of 2 degrees Celsius. Many of them fear that some of the delegates still may be wanting to invest in companies that are using fossil fuels instead of renewable energy.
That's VOA's Kim Lewis at the COP21 conference in Paris. Details coming up. Also in the news, the military says it repelled pre-dawn attacks by armed gunmen in Bujumbura. And at least 7 civilians were killed today in a suicide attack in a part of Cameroon where Boko Haram militants are active. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says a lot of progress has been made at the U.N. climate talks in Paris, but some very difficult issues must be resolved. Kerry met with French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius today after what sources said was a hard night of negotiations among the 195 nations at the Paris meetings. Fabius said the final agreement in conclusion of the talks was extended by a day until tomorrow. The biggest disagreement have been over how much financial responsibility poorer nations should take for the cost of cutting greenhouse gas emissions and what the stated long-term goal of the agreement should be. Earlier, world climate conferences had set a goal of keeping the rise in global temperatures this century to 2 degrees Celsius above worldwide levels before the industrial era started. However, new research has indicated that a lower targets such as limiting the rise in temperatures to 1.5 degrees would be preferable. The latest draft of the conference final agreement calls for the widest possible cooperation by all countries in the effort to reduce emissions of climate-altering greenhouse gases. The question of financial responsibility for emissions reduction has been a major point of contention during the talks in Paris. Representatives of 134 developing countries object to some industrial countries' efforts to set conditions for funding. VOA's Kim Lewis is at the Paris conference. She offered this update to reporter William Eagle.
This will be the first ever legally binding agreement to keep the world temperature below 2 degrees Celsius. And this final draft is scheduled to be released tomorrow here in Paris on Saturday. However, many NGOs and civil society groups, they fear that this document is not going far enough in terms of specific commitments to reach that target of 2 degrees Celsius. Many of them fear that some of the delegates still may be wanting to invest in companies that are using fossil fuels instead of renewable energy.
Kim, from your end, I know you've been monitoring, especially NGO discussions surrounding climate change. What is the reaction so far from NGOs or from Africans that you've spoken to?
What NGOs are saying is they want to make sure that negotiators are including the humanitarian aspect of this whole climate deal, and that is regarding human rights and indigenous rights. This is a big issue for them, and they said this should be a huge focus in this area because how can you talk about saving trees and land without really looking at the people? And there are people right now, they say, who are experiencing climate change on a daily basis from extreme drought to extreme flooding, as we have been covering in many parts of the continent. And overall, what they're saying, what makes this convention different, is that everyone does agree that carbon emissions, it should be reduced. And people are already taking action here. From what I have seen here, there are many kinds of innovations, ideas and inspirations that have been presented here. So they just want to make sure that the humanitarian aspect is not lost in all of this.
That was VOA's Kim Lewis. She was speaking with reporter William Eagle. There is a new warning about the severity of climate change, and it comes as the Paris Climate Summit wraps up. A Scottish study says if significant efforts are not made to counter rising temperatures, billions of people will be at risk from extreme heat, floods, droughts, and food shortages. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
The University of Edinburgh study looked at key climate factors and their estimated effect on both land and sea temperatures. It finds that if the status quo on climate change mitigation remains, land surface temperatures could rise by nearly 8 degrees Celsius by the year 2100. To put that into perspective, negotiators at the Paris conference, known as COP21, had wanted to keep temperatures just 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. That goes back to the year 1750. Many observers say climate mitigation plans submitted by many countries puts that goal out of reach. They predict at least a 3-degree increase. Roy Thompson is a professor emeritus at Edinburgh University's School of Geosciences. He blames the dire climate forecast on aerosols. These include smog, air pollutants, and smoke.
Man has both been burning fossil fuels, producing carbon dioxide, and generating a greenhouse effect. But in addition, it's been producing aerosols which have been masking how strong the greenhouse effect actually is, because the aerosols tend to cool because they reflect the sunlight.
He says by studying land and ocean temperatures, he was able to disentangle them and determine their combined effect on climate.
What I find is that the greenhouse effect is stronger than people have been thinking. And so in the future, as we continue to burn fossil fuels, emit carbon dioxide, the warming will be more pronounced than we'd previously realized.
Thompson says China is a good example of where aerosols have a big impact.
Really, what has been happening in Beijing, where they've been suffering smogs and bad visibility, and that comes from sulfate from burning what's sometimes called dirty coal.
He admits making a climate prediction for the year 2100 may not spur people to act now.
There we have the crux of the matter, that we either have to do something now by taking a firmer line on reducing greenhouse emissions, or if we don't do that, it's our descendants that will suffer.
Should global temperatures rise by 8 degrees Celsius, Professor Thompson says there would be what he calls an entirely different planet.
Life in the tropics would be particularly difficult, as organisms are pushed beyond their optimal temperatures. At the poles, both ice sheets would be melting rapidly. Plants would flower and bud earlier, but also they would desynchronize with the animals that pollinate them. Sea levels will be rising, and so people living in the poorest countries and in low-lying coastal areas would be particularly hit.
Although sea temperatures won't rise as quickly, Thompson says seas will become more acidic as carbon dioxide mixes with water. Many commercial marine species could be harmed because they have less oxygen to breathe. Despite the potential for very bad things to happen, the Edinburgh University professor says something can be done. He calls for an economic approach, namely a carbon tax. Putting a tax on the use of fossil fuels, he says, would encourage people to seek cleaner, renewable alternatives and spur invention and innovation. That, in turn, could boost economies. Thompson says if people truly worry about the future of their children and grandchildren, they'll sharply reduce the use of oil, gas, and coal. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
After 2 years of war, the International Committee of the Red Cross warns hundreds of thousands of people in South Sudan are facing severe food shortages, with many at the point of starvation. Lisa Schlein reports from ICRC headquarters in Geneva.
The International Committee of the Red Cross warns the level of hunger in South Sudan is alarmingly high, and many people are in desperate need of medical care. The Swiss humanitarian organization says for many people, the last 2 years have been a life on the run in search of food and health care and away from the dangers of warfare and sexual assault. Florence Gillette, ICRC Operations Coordinator for South Sudan, has just returned from a mission to that country. She tells VOA the ongoing fighting between the government and rebel forces has displaced more than 1.7 million South Sudanese in remote areas. She says many are effectively in hiding.
Hiding in the bush, on islands, sometimes on makeshift islands, that they have made to stay out of reach of any attacks. These people are not feeling safe enough to return to their area of origin, to their home. They are grouped in small groups in those hard-to-reach area, and they actually fled for their life and for their physical integrity.
Gillette says the ICRC and other aid groups can occasionally provide these displaced people with food, but she says not enough is reaching them, and many are barely surviving on what they can gather in the forests and the fields. As a consequence, she says, malnutrition levels are extremely high in many areas. She says providing medical care is practically impossible in some places. She notes there are many war wounded, and right now people are particularly at risk of malaria and respiratory infections.
It's difficult to say how many people are dying of those diseases because we can only work in some pockets because we don't have the means to cover the whole areas.
The warring parties signed a peace agreement earlier this year. Unfortunately, the ICRC says violence persists and the humanitarian consequences of 2 years of conflict remain of great concern. Besides the massive food needs, the agency says many people are separated from their loved ones with little hope of returning to the homes they have fled. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
An advisor to Burundi's president, Pierre Nkurunziza, says his cabinet met today and decided not to declare a state of emergency after a series of armed attacks on government facilities. The military repelled pre-dawn attacks by heavy armed gunmen today at two army barracks in Bujumbura, the capital, and a third facility south of the capital. As tensions mount in a months-long conflict over presidential politics, Kenya Airways, Rwanda Air, and Ethiopian Airlines have cancelled all flights to Burundi. However, a presidential advisor assures that the airport remains open. An army colonel says government forces killed a dozen gunmen and captured 21 others. Reports of military casualties are small but conflicting in number. Gunfire and explosions were heard around 4 a.m. this morning. Fighting continued for about 2 hours. Presidential media advisor Willy Niamitwe wrote on Twitter that the strikes were a diversion by the attackers to try to free prisoners at the military camp. In other attacks, Governor Juvenal Bigarimana of southwestern Rumonge district says yesterday the army battled nearly 100 strong force of fighters who invaded the town of Burambi, 75 miles south of Bujumbura. There are no reports on the status of earlier efforts by the European Union to resolve the conflict. The UN says at least 240 people have been killed since April and more than 200,000 have fled to neighboring countries. Burundi has been plagued with unrest since April when President Pierre Nkurunziza ran for and was elected to a third term of office. Critics said he was violating the constitution two-term limit as well as an agreement that ended Burundi's 12-year civil war. You were listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. 20 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says a lot of progress has been made at the U.N. climate talks in Paris, but some very difficult issues must be resolved. And an advisor to Burundi's President Pierre Nkurunziza says his cabinet met today and decided not to declare a state of emergency after a series of armed attacks on government facilities in Bujumbura. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. Tanzania's new president took office just last month, but he's already making headlines for his thrifty ways and his zeal in fighting waste and corruption. Lenny Ruvaga has more from Nairobi, with reporting from Dar es Salaam by Dina Chahali of VOA's Swahili service.
Barely a month in office, Tanzania's new president, John Magufuli, is going full throttle in the fight against waste and corruption. Tanzanians say they like his take-charge approach, though it is not new for him. Magufuli was nicknamed the Bulldozer for similar efforts during his 15 years as Minister of Works.
I'm very happy about it because he's the kind of guy who wants to take initiative himself and wants to show people this is how things to be done. And I think that's a fantastic way to show all the Tanzanians that what they need to do, and he's reading the way for all of them to follow him as an example.
On his first day in office this November, Magufuli made a surprise visit to the finance ministry, where he castigated civil servants who were not at their desks. Magufuli has banned foreign travel for most government officials. He cut a bloated delegation for the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Malta from 50 to just 4. Tanzanians have gleefully backed his efforts, posting their own cost-saving ideas under the Twitter hashtag, What Would Magufuli Do? Photos of Magufuli cleaning up garbage in the streets Wednesday were all over social media. He had cancelled lavish Independence Day celebrations that day and instead ordered the funds to be used to fight a cholera outbreak that had killed dozens of people and sickened nearly 5,000 more. Evidence of official corruption had been on the rise. In 2014, a scandal broke revealing that government ministers, using escrow accounts, had allegedly stolen approximately $180 million from the central bank. This month, President Magufuli suspended the Commissioner General of the Tanzania Revenue Authority on suspicion of abetting corruption and tax evasion at the Dar es Salaam port. That official is now under arrest, along with five others. The Secretary General for the ruling party, Chama cha Mapinduzi, Abdulrahman Kinana, praised the move. He told reporters this week that, and I quote, in a short period, we have seen the fruits of the anti-corruption and tax evasion-led campaign. This will benefit all the stakeholders involved, he said. This will regulate the various sources of income to ensure that all loopholes are sealed and everyone pays tax to the government so as to enable us meet our targets, end quote. Senkai Kilonzo from the Tanzanian NGO Policy Forum that deals with governance issues notes that Magufuli is drawing from his past experience.
The president's been a minister for about 20 years. He would have seen what the issues are. He would have been very concerned about wastages, outright corruption, outright theft of the public coffers, and he would have been really uncomfortable in all those years. And I assume that perhaps he's now been given the opportunity to make amends, and that's what he's trying to do.
But Kilonzo says real change will take more.
One man can't do it on his own. So I think it's all about the entire community as a nation saying we've had enough about this. It's impacting all our lives, you know. When there's less money around, you know, it means, you know, poor social services, including health and education.
Analysts say challenges await, and issues such as low pay within the civil service, which encourages graft, will have to be addressed. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
The amnesty program for ex-militants in Nigeria's oil-producing Niger Delta region is set to end this month. The program was started in 2009 to end an insurgency in the Delta by providing job training and cash payments to 30,000 militants. Now, some are worried about what comes next. Chris Stein has more on the story with reporting from Hilary Uguru in Uguli, Nigeria.
Kemapade Ebikpade used to run guns to the Niger Delta militants. Since the government started its amnesty program in 2009, he's run a welding shop while receiving about $300 a month from the government. But that money stopped arriving last month with no explanation, according to Ebikpade and 10 other ex-militants VOA spoke with.
Many people were going back to this crude oil business, fuel, kerosene, all these things will come up.
Ebikpade says he has no plans to take up arms again, but he says some militants may go back to sabotaging oil facilities, particularly the younger militants. He calls on President Muhammadu Buhari to do more to address the Delta's needs. The current status of the amnesty program is unclear. Local media reported this week that the government is just behind in its payments. When he took office in May, President Buhari said the amnesty program would end in December. He promised to continue to invest heavily in the existing projects while streamlining rehabilitation programs. But the government has given no further details. The Ministry of Niger Delta Affairs did not respond to requests for comment. Some former militants have said they will take up arms again if the payments end. They say foreign and local companies make billions of dollars pumping crude from the Delta, while local communities are polluted and impoverished. Niger Delta activist Ankio Briggs says Nigeria's successive governments have failed to develop the Delta. She calls for self-determination for the region.
For us, we have made up our minds that it is no longer acceptable that we should continue to provide all the revenue, most of the revenue that Nigeria needs, and still remain as backward and as neglected as we are.
Oil makes up about 75% of Nigeria's budget revenues, and Nigeria's economy is struggling with the global drop in the price of crude. The price of oil hit a new six-year low this week, falling to just under $37 per barrel. At the height of the insurgency, militants reduced Nigeria's oil production by about 25%. The government would be ill-prepared to handle a similar cut today. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
At least seven civilians were killed today in a suicide attack in a part of Cameroon where Boko Haram militants are active. The French news agency said the attack took place at a food stall in the town of Kolofata in northern Cameroon. The country cooperates with Chad, Benin, Nigeria and Niger on a joint military force dedicated to fighting Boko Haram. The Islamist radical group is based in northern Nigeria but has carried out regular attacks in Cameroon since 2013. On Wednesday, Cameroon's army received a U.S. shipment of combat vehicles, generators and other war equipment for the fight against Boko Haram. The U.S. deployed 300 American troops to the region 2 months ago. Last year, the United States declared Boko Haram a foreign terrorist organization and placed a $7 million bounty on its leader, Abu Bakr Shekau. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
This is a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
Ebola is not a curse or spiritual infection. It is a deadly disease, a fever spread by contact with the body fluids of infected people. I am Dr. Kande Greaves. Its symptoms start with a fever, fatigue, and muscle pain. Within a few days, vomiting and diarrhea sets in, and victims lose about 4 liters of body fluid each day. Ebola is highly infectious. If you experience any of these symptoms, seek medical help immediately. You must wash your hands regularly. Do not eat or handle bushmeat. Stay away from people suffering from Ebola. And do not handle the bodies of Ebola victims. If you have had contact with someone who has Ebola, you need to have your temperature monitored daily for any change. Early diagnosis and treatment is critical to your survival. Learn the facts about Ebola. Knowledge is life.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says a lot of progress has been made at the U.S. climate talks in Paris, but some very difficult issues must be resolved. After 2 years of war, the International Committee of the Red Cross warns hundreds of thousands of people in South Sudan are facing severe food shortages. And Tanzania's new president is already making headlines for his thrifty ways and his zeal in fighting waste and corruption. Coming up, music from Rwanda. And in our feature segment, an NGO fights to defend sexual abused children in South Africa. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm the Voice of America. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sonny Young. Hello, Sonny.
Happy Friday, Yehiz. I'm back on mic two. Yes, happy Friday.
Welcome back, Sonny. And Sonny, I understand your starting line is Kenyan Athletics.
Yehiz, Kenya Athletics is ending the year with a doping cloud hanging over the country's long-distance runners who have been renowned for decades for their international success. Three top Kenyan athletic officials were recently suspended for their roles in allegedly covering up positive doping tests. Dick Pound, the former president of the World Anti-Doping Agency, has said, and I quote, "It's pretty clear there is a lot of performance-enhancing drugs being used in Kenya." In August, at the World Championships in Beijing, two Kenyan athletes, Joyce Sakari and Koki Manunga, were suspended after testing positive for doping. The suspensions and doping allegations swirling around Kenya have some questioning the country's performance at the World Championships, where it became the first African nation to top the medals table. In this sunny side of sports highlight for 2015, reporter Shagun Dot on the spot Adeyemi looks back on Kenya's history-making performance in Beijing.
Good evening, Africa. Kenya has made history by becoming the first African nation to emerge the overall winner of the two yearly World Athletics Championships. The East African nation finished on top of the medals table at the 15th edition of the championships. Kenya won a total of 7 gold, 6 silver, and 3 bronze medals to finish ahead of Jamaica with 7 gold, 2 silver and 3 bronze medals, and the United States with 6 each of gold, silver and bronze. Until this year's edition, Kenya's best outing was a second place overall finish at the 2007 edition of the championships in Osaka, Japan. In the first edition of the championships in Helsinki, Finland in 1983, Kenya did not even appear on the medals table. Altogether, 8 African teams made it to the medals table at the 2015 edition. They are, in the order in which they finished, Kenya, Ethiopia, South Africa, Eritrea, Egypt, Tunisia, Morocco, and Uganda. Congratulations to Kenya, the overall winner of the 2015 World Athletics Championships, for this great achievement. In one of the highlights the final day, African runners made it a 1-2 finish in the women's marathon. Mary Dibaba of Ethiopia won the gold in 2 hours, 27 minutes and 35 seconds. She was followed by Hella Kiprop of Kenya in 2 hours, 27 minutes and 36 seconds. For the sunny side of sports, this is Shegun Adeyemi in Lagos.
The Voice of America, VOA.
Kenya's 7th and final gold medal in Beijing was won by Asbel Kiprop, who came from behind to win his 3rd consecutive world title in the men's 1500 meters final.
I knew that when it comes to the last 200, 250 meters, remember that's how McLaughlin won Olympics in London here in the last 250. I've been looking at his qualifying rounds when he races my colleague here. They've been running both of them the last 250 meters. But when you compare his last 50 meters, it's not moving. So I was a little bit confident that maybe that's where I could catch them.
That's Asbel Kiprop of Kenya, the three-time world champion in the men's 1500 meters race. And Kiprop was speaking in Beijing, China. Kenya's six other gold medal winners in Beijing were Julius Yago in the men's javelin, David Rudisha in the men's 800 meters race, Nicholas Bett in the men's 400 meters hurdles race, Ezekiel Kemboy in the men's 3000 meters steeplechase race, Hyvin Jepkemoy in the women's 3,000 meters steeplechase race, and Vivian Chariot in the women's 10,000 meters final. Truly a great showing by the Kenyans at the World Athletics Championships. Meanwhile, two Kenyans who won gold medals at this year's World Championships in Beijing have received a big honor in Nairobi. The VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman Mark Ouma has that story as well as other sports news.
Julius Yego and Vivian Chariot were crowned the 2015 Kenya Male and Female Athlete of the Year in Nairobi, Kenya on Thursday night. Yego, the world javelin champion, is the first Kenyan to win a gold medal in a field event on the global stage. Chariot earned accolade after winning the 10,000 meters at the World Championship. Four-time world 3,000-meter steeplechase champion Ezekiel Kemboy received the Men's Long Distance Award, while three-time world 1,500-meter champion Asbel Kiprop received the Middle Distance Award. World 400-meter hurdles champion Nicholas Bett bagged the Outstanding Performance Award. Eliud Kipchoge, victor at the London and Berlin Marathons, scooped the Men's Road Running Award, while Gladys Cherono, the Berlin Marathon winner, bagged the Women's Road Running Award. Kumari Turkey, the 1500-meter gold medalist at the World Youth Championship, Africa Youth Championship, and Commonwealth Youth Games, earned the Young Male Athlete of the Year Award, while World Youth 2000-meter steeplechase champion Selfyn Chespol was named the Young Female Athlete of the Year. Meanwhile, seven countries have submitted bids to stage the World Race Walking Team Championship and the World Junior Athletics Championships due next year, the IAAF revealed in Monaco. Ecuador, Italy, Mexico and Ukraine are vying to stage the race walking event, while Australia, India and Poland have their sights trained on the Junior Athletics Championship. The bidding process became necessary after Russia, the original host for the two events, was suspended from World Athletics. Turning to football, the curtains come down at the Under-23 Africa Cup of Nations when Algeria and Nigeria clash in the finals in Dakar, Senegal, tomorrow Saturday. Prior to the finals, Senegal faced South Africa in the bronze medal playoff. In Japan, the Democratic Republic of Congo's Orange Africa Champions League title holders TP Mazembe tackled Japan's Sanferese Hiroshima in the quarterfinals at the FIFA Club World Cup in Osaka on Sunday. Sanferese Hiroshima earned the right to challenge TP Mazembe following their 2-0 victory over New Zealand's Auckland City in Yokohama on Thursday. In rugby, Kenya play England as South Africa face Zimbabwe at the start of the second leg of the IRB 7 series in Cape Town, South Africa tomorrow Saturday. All four teams are drawn in the same group for their preliminary round fixtures. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend.
Because this is Africa. This time for Africa.
Very excited. Because
this is Africa. This time for Africa.
Human rights group Amnesty International says the corruption crisis in football's world governing body, FIFA, is drawing attention away from abuses of migrant workers helping to construct venues for the 2022 World Cup in Qatar. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Amnesty says in recent months, Qatar has made some progress in improving the rights of migrant workers. Under the so-called new wage protection system, big companies must now regularly pay their employees by electronic bank transfer, helping to address problems over late or missing wages. But Amnesty's Mustafa Kadri says there are still holes in the legislation.
Workers that are most exposed to abuse in Qatar are those employed in the smallest companies. And they might have a three-month visa, they may be informally employed. They're very hard to track these small companies. This law does not seem to effectively apply to that pool of workers.
There are around 1.5 million migrant workers in Qatar. Most are employed under the kafala sponsorship system, where the employer is responsible for their legal status. Amnesty says this led to major abuses, including the confiscation of employees' passports.
An employer has the power to control where a worker goes, when they leave the country, whether they can change jobs. And the fact that that creates an incredible power imbalance.
Qadri accuses FIFA, football's world governing body, and the organiser of the World Cup of abdicating its responsibilities.
We do have a concern that the focus on the corruption allegations and FIFA's leadership is diverting attention away from human rights and FIFA's responsibility with respect to human rights.
Qatar has strongly denied claims that its officials paid FIFA delegates to win their votes to host the 2022 World Cup, and FIFA's ethics committee ruled in November that any breaches of the rules were only of very limited scope. Swiss police are investigating corruption claims against suspended FIFA head Sepp Blatter, while scores of FIFA officials have been indicted in an ongoing US investigation. Speaking in London Thursday, US Attorney General Loretta Lynch urged wholesale reform.
It's incumbent upon every country that participates in this great sport to be involved in FIFA's reform.
José Luis Meisner, the former General Secretary of South American Soccer's governing body, appeared this week before an Argentine judge who will decide on an extradition request from the United States. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Voice of America's news, talk and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
I encourage our VOA listeners with internet access to check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. The address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. You'll see photos and videos, and you can post your comments. So check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page.
Voice of America!
And follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at VOA Sunny Sports. Omiachi Job, whose Twitter handle is Creativity, sent me a tweet, and Omiachi kept it simple, 140 characters or less. Big, big pleasure getting you on this platform. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Yeheus Wuhi.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sun has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, an NGO fights to defend sexually abused children in South Africa. And next, a young South Sudanese trying to bring peace to his country through technology. But first, some music. Here is Miss Jojo from Rwanda with Nendine.
Ma friend, iyo mbona mijisubizo chivivazo bzawe.
Miss Jojo from Rwanda with Nindine. Research by South Africa's Medical Research Council say half the country's children will be sexually abused before the age of 18. Other organizations report that a quarter of children under the age of 16 in South Africa have been sexually abused. That's about 4 million youngsters. Most of these children don't get help and are condemned to lives of suffering. However, a few rise above their circumstances to become remarkable human beings. Darren Taylor reports in one such case in the final installment of a series on South Africans making a difference.
A girl with long blonde hair, a wide smile, azure eyes and a vivacious personality sits in an office inside a colonial-era house next to one of Johannesburg's busiest hospitals.
She was sexually abused by her father with mother's agreement from very, very young.
Trish Heslop is the director of Guild Cottage. It's the only specialist residential treatment centre for sexually abused, traumatised children in South Africa.
As a little girl of about 5, she was deflecting abuse from her younger siblings. She took the brunt of it. Sexual abuse, emotional abuse, physical abuse, beaten with a stick. A child with great resilience and a child who's smart.
The institution's experts are giving 15-year-old Jessica the counselling she needs to overcome her brutal past. She arrived at the cottage almost 3 years ago from foster parents who weren't able to deal with her unique problems.
I was sad for leaving home, but the other side, I was happy because I knew that they were going to help me and for me to move on with my life.
Jessica's caregivers found a school for her, but Heslop says because of the damage done to her and her desire to fit in with peers, she almost destroyed herself.
Her first year in high school, because she tries to please, she got involved in some of the drugs that were around, and we got her into rehab.
Jessica says she'll never forget the staff of Guild Cottage for their patience and for forgiving her for her mistakes.
I've messed up a lot and they've gave me chances. They've loved me and they've always been there.
The cottage's psychologists and other therapists forge close relationships with girls like Jessica in an atmosphere of trust and caring.
We don't believe in warehousing children. We believe in giving children experiences, normalizing them, sending them to schools, letting them go on school camps, go to the movies so they can talk to their friends at school about the latest, I was going to say Minions movie, I think I'm probably 6 months behind the times, and dressing them well. They can't wear rags. They've got to look like they belong in the community. So
because of its policy to provide nothing but quality for the girls, Guild Cottage is locked in a constant battle to survive. The state provides only a quarter of the funds it needs. It relies on private donations for the balance.
I beg a lot, very good at begging, but people are very tired of giving money. This is a country that has many, many needs and not enough money to spread around. At the moment, we're deep in a hole somewhere. We're kind of trying to dig our way out. The government give us
a tight budget means the cottage only has the means to help 18 girls on the premises. After intensive therapy and just living the life of a normal teenager, Heslop says Jessica's now thriving.
She values education enormously. She works very hard. She is involved in sports in school. She is just a girl who works so hard. And she is prepared to succeed at whatever she does. She studies. She's probably sitting studying right now. And the school love her because this is a child who, she's polite, she's respectful, she's a good role model for other kids.
Jessica remembers how she once felt worthless. Now she's a confident young woman determined to succeed.
My favorite subjects is math and accounting because I want to become an accountant one day.
She says if it wasn't for Guild Cottage, she'd probably be an empty failure or even dead.
I wouldn't have realized how important school is and how important it is to not hurt yourself and to do bad stuff to yourself or to use drugs and stuff to kill yourself. I'll leave Guild Cottage, but I'll always come back because I'll miss them. They become a family.
Jessica says it's her dream to one day establish a similar organization to help children who are much worse off than her.
Because Guild helped me and they showed me mercy and they love us, so I'll want to be like that and help people because I got helped. So why not help them to see the brighter future, to leave the darkness behind and move on.
Piles of proposals to potential donors teeter on Heslop's desk. She hopes some will be successful, giving Guild Cottage the funds to stay open, money that will allow it to create more Jessicas. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
A young South Sudanese is trying to bring peace to his country through technology. He says young people can learn to create their own jobs in the technology sector while helping to grow their country. That mission has brought him to four U.S. states and the District of Columbia, where Ian Bior spoke to him.
Thomas Samuel Muto is convinced that technology and innovation is the core of most growing economies in the world. He believes that young people in South Sudan can take information and communications technology training, or ICT, to help maximize their potential. That message brought the founder of the Juba-based Youth Technology Development Organization here in November as part of the U.S. Department of State's International Visitors Leadership Program. Muto says he has been working to get more support for the technology industry from the South Sudan government.
We are behind in technology, in terms of technology. This is the right time that we, in the continent, as Africa, and especially South Sudan as a young country, as a new country, that's the first step that we need to establish.
Muto says he knows that becoming an entrepreneur in South Sudan's fledgling technology sector is an uphill battle. For example, it's not easy to charge computers, tablets, or phones in South Sudan because electricity is unreliable. Weak internet connectivity is also a big problem. But young entrepreneurs like himself see opportunity, not obstacles, in a country like South Sudan.
If our home is in fire, it means that we need to contribute. Contribution that can bring our home into peace. We need to pour water to that fire that is burning back in home so that we will have peace in the country.
Muto says what bothers him the most about his troubled homeland is what he describes as a lack of unity among youth. He says he wants to encourage young people to put their country first and leave tribal or ethnic differences behind. But he says a lot of frustration is due to the fact that there are simply no jobs in South Sudan.
Young people are defending on waiting for the government to provide jobs. So that's a challenge that at the end of the day you find that youth, when anything that comes, driven their mind to violence, they're easy to be engaged to that violence.
Muto says above all, change in South Sudan will come when everyone puts their country first.
So if we focus into that focus that we are South Sudanese, we are country, we are one people, it means that whatever we will be focusing in, wherever we go, we will be focusing into the unity of our country. What is killing our country now is the divisions.
Muto plans to return to Juba this week. He says his stay in the United States has renewed his commitment to help develop his country. Muto says although he has no firm commitments from any individuals or companies, he plans to use the connections he's made in the U.S. to move his nonprofit forward. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at VOA Africa. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Lennis Remkes, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Foreign Minister of the Republic of Angola, Jorge Chicot, made an official visit to the United States on November 18th. The meeting between U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Foreign Minister Chicot was the second ministerial-level meeting of the U.S.-Angola Strategic Partnership Dialogue. The two delegations reviewed the advances made in the bilateral relationship over the past year since the previous strategic dialogue in December 2014. The United States congratulated Angola on the progress made over its 40 years of independence. The United States and Angola reaffirmed their pledge to work together on the UN Security Council to address critical global and regional issues. The two countries also committed to working together to find a peaceful resolution to the crisis in Burundi, Democratic Republic of the Congo, and South Sudan. Both the United States and Angola recognize the importance of intensifying and diversifying the bilateral trade and investment cooperation while upholding international commitments and standards. Angola and the United States agreed to build on the progress made during the International Maritime Security Conference by strengthening collaboration in the area of maritime security, particularly in the development and elaboration of a national maritime strategy. Angola reaffirmed its commitment to work with the United States to combat money laundering and terrorism financing. Angola and the United States reaffirmed their commitment to support the further development of democratic institutions and respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms, including freedom of expression, assembly, press, and religion. The United States and Angola expressed their satisfaction with the first bilateral human rights dialogue, which was held in November 2015, as a positive advancement in mutually addressing issues of concern. Angola reaffirmed its interest to join the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative and Voluntary Principles and underlined its ongoing review of the agreements. The United States congratulated Angola on its successful Kimberley Process chairmanship, particularly the accomplishment of expanding the Kimberley Process dialogue to include discussions on the voluntary principles and anti-money laundering and counter-terrorist financing. The United States is proud to continue working with its partner Angola for the security, prosperity, and happiness of its peoples, the African region, and the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations, VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views, presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
VOA News is always at the tip of your fingers.
All the news you want about Africa and the world, day and night, is available on voaafrica.com. VOA Africa.